This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Nicky Filippi. It is the 31st of January, 2001, at approximately 3 o'clock in Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Filippi is in Seattle, Washington. Sir, where were you, when and where were you born?
I was born in Seattle, Washington on the 18th of December of 1937.
Did you grow up there?
Yes, I went through school here in Seattle and then joined the Army in 1955.
Okay. What was it like growing up in Seattle in the 1950s, the beginnings of the Cold War and after the Second World War and all kinds of interesting activities globally? Were you aware of these things? Or?
Well, I was aware mostly starting with the Korean War of Seattle being a port of embarkation to Korea. There was a lot of military activity in town. There's always been an existing fort south of Seattle, Fort Lewis, and there was a embarkation station, Fort Lawton, in Seattle, so there was a great deal of military activity during the Korean War.
Okay. And were current events and international affairs something that you gravitated towards as an interest?
Yes, I've always had an interest in the world totally, and have subscribed to the various news magazines, and my parents owned a book and record store, so I had a long exposure to books of all nature.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what led you to join the Army?
Decided to join the Army in 55 and served in the Army for a 10-year period before being released in the 60s to go with Air America.
What was your MOS in the Army?
Well, I started in the Signal Corps and then went into military intelligence, and I applied for flight school while I was a counterintelligence agent, and went through flight school and went to Vietnam in 1965 with the 1st Cavalry Division. And during my tour in Vietnam, I had a lot of friends that I had known in the Army and in flight school that had gone with Air America and applied at the time to go with Air America. Mm-hmm. And I was released from the Army in 1967 in June and hired on with Air America within about a week of that.
Wow. Now, what in your counterintelligence experiences in the 1950s and early 60s, was there very much cooperation or interagency activity between, say, U.S. Army military intelligence, counterintelligence, and CIA counterintelligence, DIA counterintelligence, those other organizations?
I wouldn't want to go into any of that right now.
Okay, good enough. Your transition to Vietnam, what point was that?
Well, I went to Vietnam, as I say, in the summer of 1965 with the 1st Cav Division as an aviator and an assistant intelligence officer for the Air Cav Squadron, and had a split tour over there. 8 months after I got there, I was transferred down to the Mekong Delta and spent an additional 8 months in the Mekong Delta for a total of 16 months before I returned to the United States, processed out to go back with Air America in 1967.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was your time with the cab like?
Well, it was a very interesting experience because we were the first total Army division to deploy to Vietnam and went through the major battles of Viet Drang, the first fixed-place battle of the war, which took place in the fall of 1965. Mm-hmm. And it was the actually the validation of the air mobility concepts that had taken place back in Fort Benning, Georgia, before the 1st Cav was formed up out of the 11th Air Assault Division.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you arrived in Vietnam, what did you think was actually going on in that country?
Well, I pretty well knew what was going on because in 1961-1962 time frame, I was stationed in Korea as a counterintelligence agent, and I knew what had been going on in Vietnam after the French lost at Dien Bien Phu and the things that were happening down there with the advisory group and so forth. So I had a pretty good understanding of what was occurring in Vietnam. And at the time, of course, American policy under Truman and Eisenhower was one of containment. And that's how we more or less slipped into the Vietnam engagement, trying to contain communism wherever it appeared to be cropping up.
Mm-hmm. So based on your experience in Korea, the basically what was presented to the American people, that is, the purpose of American involvement in South Vietnam is to create this bulwark in Southeast Asia against communism. This was validated or...
Well, that was basically the Truman Doctrine at the mm-hmm. time was one of containment mm-hmm. of communism wherever it flared up around the world. So this was consistent mm-hmm. with the that view of mm-hmm. containment.
Okay. Now, how much about Vietnamese or I guess political events had you been aware of in terms?
Well,
of
only what was published in the news magazines, mm-hmm. which. Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report, wherever I've gone mm-hmm. in the world, I've always subscribed to those three magazines, and they pretty much covered the events, the business, of course, while I was in flight school when Kennedy was assassinated mm-hmm. shortly after Diem was assassinated over in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's ironic because right now in China, religious persecution is bringing on self-immolation over there, and that's part of the problems that were caused in South Vietnam. The monks were self-immolating at the time and causing a great disruption for the Diem government.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of ironic here, what, 30, 40 years later, it's happening in China.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty well known. The papers were full of what was going on mm-hmm. in Vietnam at the time, if you just took the time to read.
Yes, sir. Okay. You mentioned that you were in Vietnam as a pilot for the CAV during the Yadrang Valley
yes.
battle. Did you know General or then Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore?
Only indirectly. I was with the CAV squadron, and I think I had met him just in passing during the air assault efforts.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very familiar with the battle and how it was brought on and so forth, and how. The 1st of the 9th, the CAV squadron was sent in to establish contact with the Viet Cong, and then from there on it escalated, and it turned out after the fact that these were North Vietnamese regulars that we were battling down in the Chupong Mastiff area where the Battle of Viet Dreng took place.
Mm-hmm. And during that battle, did you actually fly operations?
I was involved in both flight operations, and I was the assistant S2 for the CAV squadron.
Okay.
So I was in the headquarters module, working the radios and whatnot, and had an opportunity to see the thing as it unfolded.
Mm-hmm. Have you had an opportunity to read "We Were Soldiers Once and Young"?
Yes, I have.
What did you think of that depiction of the battle?
Well, I thought it was a very nice chronicle. Of the issue, and it jived with what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically involved with the fighting battalions that were put on the ground, and the 1st of the 9th is mentioned in it, along with John B. Stockton, the commander of the 1st of the 9th.
Mm-hmm.
But the major battle itself was fought by the infantry battalions.
Okay.
And once again, I was in the CAV squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't assigned to one of the infantry battalions.
Yes, sir. Would you? I would assume as the S2 that, but you did engage in some of the briefings for the infantry commanders going out and things of that nature.
Well, no, I was working in the squadron headquarters itself.
Okay.
And normally, the policy, the deployment of a CAV squadron, a troop,
mm-hmm.
Which is the company-sized element within the squadron, will be detached from the squadron and attached to a brigade to support that brigade. So it's being done at company level.
Mm-hmm.
And back at the squadron level, which is equivalent to battalion, you're basically monitoring what your unit is doing in support of the ground brigades.
Okay. Was there anything else or any other particular operations that come to mind concerning your Vietnam, your first?
Oh, there were a whole host of operations. After Ye Drang, we went out on the coastal plains, and that was the start of the business that went on and developed later into the Ashaw Valley and so forth. But there were a whole series of operations in the highlands, and then, as I say, after an eight-month period, I transferred down to the Mekong Delta, and there the aviation was in support of Vietnamese units rather than U.S. Army units, and they ran continuous operations down there in the Delta for the 8 months that I was there.
Mm-hmm. What was your assessment when you were in the Delta of the ARVN forces you supported?
Well, by and large, they were just struggling along, and it appeared that there was, in most of the engagements, it was pretty well established. If they knew that we were coming, they hung back. I'm talking about the enemy. The enemy hung back, and there were no real severe engagements. The few engagements that we had down there is where you stumbled into somebody inadvertently.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be action, but there was kind of a system that appeared to go on in the Delta where each side had carved out its own territory, and it was kind of live and let live at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in the, as I say, in the 1966 time frame.
Yes, sir. And in 66, had there ever been any rumors or were you aware of any incidents of Viet Cong infiltration of ARVN units and the, I guess...
No, I wouldn't be involved in that because I was working purely as a pilot at that time when I was down in the Delta,
mm-hmm.
and that was not a question that we dealt with.
Okay.
I wasn't acting as an intelligence officer when I was down in the Delta.
But and as a pilot, you never experienced anything like that?
Well, no, not that I recall. I think it was a general assumption that there was infiltration, but it never where it caused any particular problem.
Okay. Well, how did you, when you were in the Delta, is that where you heard about Air America? Or did you
I mentioned I was a special agent in Korea in the 60s time frame, so I've been... well aware of Air America since the early 1960s because they had a what they called a bookbinder flight that went out of Seoul over to Tokyo.
Okay.
And we'd often ride that. I was a DC-4, as I recall. So I was familiar with what Air America was back in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in Vietnam, I'd run into some pilots that I had gone to or had been in flight school slightly ahead of me and had been in the 11th Air Assault Division before we became First Cav, and they had left the Army and joined Air America, and I'd met them over there at various bases,
mm-hmm.
and more or less just gravitated toward applying for Air America.
Okay.
And the battalion commander supported my request. He wanted me to stay in the Army at the time, and I told him I was intent on joining Air America, so he wrote a letter of support to Air America, and I think that was instrumental in them bringing me on when they did.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you know the true nature of Air America's funding and organization?
More or less, I knew that from my experience in Korea.
Okay. It's a lot of the other Air America pilots I've talked to have said that they always suspected, but they never really knew that they were part of the CIA.
Well, I think I, out of Korea, I pretty well knew because they had supported efforts in China after the fall of the mainland in 1949. They'd been continuously operating as civil air transport or in some other guise. And I would say I was pretty much aware of what the whole thing was about. It was never a question in my mind.
Okay. So you went from flying helicopters for the Army to flying helicopters for Air America?
That's correct.
Okay. You never transitioned to fixed wing?
No.
Okay. When you went to work for Air America, were you stationed out of Udorn?
Udorn, yes. Udorn. We were hired. They just started a new program. Up until the summer of 67, the primary helicopter up in Laos was the H-34. And seven of us were hired on in the summer of 67 who had Huey experience because they were assigning, they were buying and assigning Hueys, UH-1s, to Udorn. And seven of us were hired on at the same time in the June time frame of 67 to proceed to Udorn and work with some of the older pilots who were up there who had bid the new Huey program from the H-34 program.
Okay. Did that work involve Marius Burke?
Yes, it certainly did.
Okay. And I guess the what was the primary role of you and the other pilots of Air America flying out of Udorn using those
units? Just basically supporting the operations up in Laos.
Okay. From your perspective as an Army intelligence officer and pilot, and then as an Air America pilot, what was the whole role, the purpose of the American presence in Laos? How did it fit into the bigger picture?
Well, it was basically just a delaying action, if you will, trying to pull off as many North Vietnamese to into Laos that would preclude them from bothering American elements in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So the more activity that could be done up in Laos, the more they'd have to sacrifice manpower to overcome that activity, and that was less manpower that could go down south into Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. How about anti-communist activities?
On whose part?
Well, for instance, against the Pathet Lao and communist forces that were trying
the Pathet Lao and the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia mm-hmm. were the local subset mm-hmm. of the larger North Vietnamese desire to reintegrate Indochina under a communist banner, if you would. So there were participants, the Viet Cong in Vietnam, the Pathet Lao in Laos, and the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, who were basically local forces, if you will, and they were supported by the North Vietnamese.
How much control from your positions and your own perspective, how much control do you think North Vietnam had over those various groups, the Viet Cong, the Pathet Lao, and the Khmer Rouge?
Well, I think it was to the same extent that what power, you could say, what power did China or Russia have? Mm-hmm. Vietnam was basically a client state in that regard in terms of achieving technology to pursue their war effort from Russia and China, and it would be probably analogous to think of your local forces, the three that we mentioned, mm-hmm. Being dependent on the North Vietnamese in turn to supply them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Sure, but I'd be curious what you would think about the analogy or the applicability, the possible applicability of the analogy of the South Vietnamese to the United States. I mean, how much control do you think we had over their policy and their activities?
Well, I think that we tried, mm-hmm. but we more or less took the war away from the Vietnamese. From the years starting in about 1965 through the beginning of what was called Vietnamization, which was instituted by Nixon as a means to extricate ourselves from Vietnam. But we had trained a lot of Vietnamese back in the States at the infantry school, aviation school, engineer school, and so forth, and sent them back to Vietnam, but we basically were running the war for most of that period with Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so it left the Vietnamese somewhat bereft in their ability to prosecute it. And then all of a sudden, in the 70s, we turned around and just dropped the whole thing back in their lap and said, well, it's yours now.
Mm-hmm. Very complicated situation.
Oh, very, extremely complicated situation.
Yeah. What? Why don't you go ahead and describe your first flight for Air America, if you can?
Well, the way the system worked at that time, when we arrived in Udorn in the summer of 67, the Hueys that they anticipated being there had not arrived. So they put us into the H-34s, flying co-pilot in the H-34s, and we went up country into Laos and stayed at particular stations up there for so many flight hours at each station until over a period of a few months we had been indoctrinated into the peculiarities of flying in Laos through Air America pilots who were in the H-34 program and had an opportunity to more or less see the whole country by going from RON place to RON place and spending 25, 30 flight hours in each place. We pretty well had geographic orientation completed by the time the Hueys came in later in the fall of the year.
I understand that given that great training program, getting the pilots so familiar with the terrain, that was very important in keeping you, the pilots, the aircraft, and the other personnel that were involved out of harm's way. But what was the role of the intelligence briefing?
Oh, the role of what?
Of intelligence briefings. I mean, you guys got some pretty good intelligence briefings, too.
Well, Air America ran a intel section. And the intel section, of course, was as good as the pilot's debriefing. In other words, if you had a mission and you went up country and you spent so many days in a particular area, if you took the time when you came back to Udorn to stop into intel and brief them on what you were doing and where you perceived enemy positions to be and so forth, that would go up on the board, and pilots that in the following days would derive their briefings from the input of pilots who had flown in the area previously. Which is, you know, that's standard military G2 or S2 shop, whether it's Air Force or Marines, Navy. It works the same way. It's just a continuing updating of data, pilots being briefed and then being debriefed after they've flown their mission.
It just, based on some of the other discussions I've had with pilots that flew for Air America, it seems like they had a very good system for making sure that everybody knew where not to fly if you didn't want to get shot at.
Well, they had a very, you know, they had a vested interest in doing this,
right,
and everybody worked together to ensure that other people didn't inadvertently stumble into a place that was already known as being owned by the enemy, where especially when any type of heavy anti-aircraft was known, you got that. You didn't wait till you came back. You would call that back, or pass it to another pilot who was returning to make sure that he briefed on it, because everyone was in the same boat, and so you did everything you could to keep intel informed.
These debriefings were verbal, not written?
Pardon?
Were the debriefings verbal? And
yeah, they were verbal. They had an intel shop, and they had maps on the wall, and you'd go in there and say, okay, today I'm going to go, or for the next week or whatever, I'm going to leave Udorn, and I'm going to go up to Laos, and I'm going to work this particular area. Tell me all you know about it. And what's new, and you'd have your maps with you, and you just go in there, and any new information on activity, you just plot on your map and take it with you when you went.
Okay. But what about the debriefings? When you came
the same
back,
thing, when you come back,
uh-huh.
when you came back, you'd stop in the shop, and if you had discovered anything up there and written it on your map, you'd transfer it from your map to the debriefer, telling him that you'd encountered this, that, or whatever. And he'd post it on his maps in the shop, in the intel shop, for all subsequent pilots coming in.
Gotcha. I guess I'm trying to get to the idea that you guys didn't sit down and write these lengthy reports after operations.
Oh, no. I don't. The only time over there that I ever remember writing any type of report is if there was a catastrophic incident of something where an aircraft crashed or something of that nature, and you would write your impressions down and give it to the bosses as a means of what you'd observed. But other than that, no, it wasn't a written thing. You'd write it on your map, or you'd make notes on your knee board, and you would pass those on verbally to the intel officer. And that's normally how it's done in Army shops, too, at least at the tactical level.
So what was it like flying for Air America in 1967?
Oh, it was wonderful. In fact, the entire 8 years I was with them, plus the 16 months that I spent over there in Vietnam, that decade was the best decade of my life. We were at a dinner the other night in town in Seattle, and a bunch of us, about 50 Air America people, including the spouses, about 20 families, and I think we all agreed it was pretty much a consensus that those 10 years were about the best decade of our life in terms of enjoyment and work satisfaction and excitement and everything else.
Okay. Did you have family?
I didn't when I went over there, but I met a Thai lady when I was in the Army and had visited Bangkok 3 times when I was in the Army. And continued to see her, and when I came back, we resumed our relationship from when I had left from the Army. Mm-hmm. And we were, I'd met her in 65, we were engaged in 67, we were married in 69, and we've been together for the last 32 years.
That's great.
And my daughter was born there in 1971.
Okay, so she spent 4 years in country.
I'm sorry?
She spent 4 years in country. From 71 to 75, she was there.
Yeah, my daughter spent her first 4 years in country before we left there.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and jump forward for a minute and talk about a search and rescue operation that you are a part of involving Al Martin. And if you would, just go ahead and describe the events as you remember them.
Well, it was just a regular work day in northern Laos, flying out of Site 20 alternate. I'd gone up north, and I don't recall exactly what site I was working that day. It could have been 36 or any of the ones that were north of the Plain of Jars. And I was returning to Lima Site 20 alternate with the intention of being on the ground before it got completely dark. And it was at about the dusk time frame, or slightly after dusk, when I heard Colonel Martin's call that he was having trouble and that he thought he was over the middle of the Plain of Jars. And my position at the time was on the very western side of the Plain of Jars. The Plain of Jars at that time was contested. There were enemy on the eastern side and friendlies on the western side. So we would normally fly around the western side as we would either go north or come back south. And when I heard his emergency call, I was heading approximately south at that time, and knew from his position he'd be off my left side. I turned to the east and asked him to turn on his landing light, and he turned on his landing light, and I was able to identify where he was, and told him that there was a airstrip below him, but that the airstrip had been damaged with a bomb crater halfway down. And I told him that if he desired to land, I would be proceeding in his direction. And if he wished to land on the strip, fine, but be aware that the bomb crater was there. And he lined up to land, and he landed from west to east. And as he approached the bomb crater, it appeared he tucked his landing gear up and slid on in on his empty belly tanks. And as I approached from west to east, I saw his aircraft. I saw him exiting the aircraft, and he came down the wing, and I landed by his aircraft and had him brought on board and put in the left seat. We took off and proceeded to Lima Site 20 alternate. And that was all there was to it. It was basically a classic SAR, but at the time Air America had a primary SAR mission in Laos. The Air Force also was very much a part of this, but they had a lot of restrictions placed on them that Air America did not have. So we were very cognizant of the fact that oftentimes we were up there alone, so we had a very fine system worked out within Air America to extract our own pilots. Mm-hmm. And that went along with any Navy, Marine, or Air Force pilots who were shot down up there. We did everything we could to get them out as expeditiously as we could.
Mm-hmm.
It was routine.
It was a routine thing that all pilots were expected to do.
Yeah, well, yes, it's just kind of an unwritten code that when someone goes down, you're going to bust your chops to get them out, because it was found by experience that if you could get to someone in the first 20-25 minutes, you had a very, very good chance of getting them out
mm-hmm.
before the enemy could react to trying to, they might see them go down, but before they could react to picking them up, if you got in and out, you could do it in 20 minutes with no problem if you were close enough.
And this was September of 1969, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. You mentioned earlier a letter that Colonel Martin had written.
Well, yes, sometime in October, a letter was forwarded to Udorn mentioning the incident and just thanking me for happening to be out there and in the air and able to assist him at the time. And that was quite common. If we picked someone up, they'd recognize us with a note,
mm-hmm.
and it made us feel very good.
Mm-hmm. There has been some speculation by individuals that Air America pilots would receive some form of special compensation for that type of operation, SAR operation.
No, that's totally fallacious. Basically, we were paid on a pay scale that included our basic flight time, overtime, and there was hazardous duty time and so forth. And the only way that you would make any money on picking up a down pilot, if it happened to be the last day of the month, because the time was kept by month,
mm-hmm.
if it was the last day of the month and you had planned to be on the ground at 6 o'clock in the evening, and for some reason on that last day, just before you landed, you diverted to pick up a down pilot and you landed at 7 o'clock, you'd have one more hour than you anticipated. And if you were on overtime at the time, our pay base was 70 hours a month. Hours over 70 were paid overtime. So if you had one more hour than you'd anticipated that month, you would have been paid the standard overtime pay. But it wouldn't have mattered whether you were on a SAR or the customer who you were working for decided that he had some last-minute thing to do. It was six of one, half a dozen of another. There was no premium
mm-hmm.
paid for picking up a down pilot. That was a rumor that went on and on and on, but it's totally fallacious.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What you mentioned that it was a typical day, this day in September of 1969. Why don't you go ahead and describe what a typical day for an Air America pilot in 1969 was?
Well, regardless of whether you're a fixed wing or rotorcraft, you would be briefed by the people you were working for on what they wanted you to do on a given day. For example, we would be living at a hostel at 20 Alternate, and the night before we had a pretty good idea. We were told which customer we'd be working for, and in the morning we would take off and proceed to a Laos site away from 20 Alternate, where we would work for that customer and do anything that that customer wanted. And basically, we were providing all the services that were provided by the Army in Vietnam. We transported troops. We moved people into various positions. We conducted combat assaults on behalf of the Laotian Army. We did resupply. We did medical evacuations. Just whatever the particular customer had to do that day: moving of ammunition, moving of people, moving of supplies.
Mm-hmm.
It was, each day was different. But when I say a routine day, it was just a typical day of aviation support work.
Right. Did you ever engage in FAC activities?
Well, yes, you would. We would go quite often on missions, which were generally called deep missions, to either put patrols in or something of that nature. And we were provided air support by the U.S. Air Force, and they had facts there, but when we would go out on these missions, facts would not go with us, but we basically did the facting ourselves as we were flying the mission. If we engaged or were engaged by anti-aircraft, we would throw smoke out the window and tell the aircraft fighters that were supporting us the position that we perceived of the gunfire from the smoke, and they would go in and suppress that anti-aircraft.
Okay. And
but we didn't act as formal facts. It was just simply that there wasn't a fact there, so we were dealing directly with the Air Force support.
Mm-hmm. How about Royal Lao Air Force Air Power and Air America pilots?
They worked basically independent of us. They worked with the Air Force facts that were stationed out of 20 alternate.
Okay.
And generally worked independent of us, but once again, if a Laotian pilot went down, we would respond to him the same way we would to an American pilot.
Mm-hmm. Did most Laotian pilots speak English?
I'm sorry?
Did most Laotian pilots speak English?
Yeah, generally, English is the lingua franca of aviation throughout the world, so most everyone who is trained in a formal aviation program picks up English. It's more or less a prerequisite. So when they were dealing with us, of course, they'd speaking in English. When they were dealing with themselves, I'm sure they spoke Lao.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the time that you were working in Vietnam, I mean in Laos and in Vietnam later, I guess, you knew that the customers, as they were referred to, were actually CIA case officers.
Well, I don't know if you'd say knew. I would say that you had a fairly good idea. No one presented credentials to anybody saying I'm this or I'm that, but it was pretty much the general assumption.
Mm-hmm. And did most of the customers go by nicknames?
They went by their call signs.
Call signs.
Yeah, they had a radio call sign, so when you communicate with them while you were working for them, you would work with them by call sign.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that what caught me was the way you phrased it. You said that basically you guys would do anything that the customers wanted you to do. I've heard an alternative version of that service with certain caveats.
Well, of course.
We would do anything, but there are certain things that couldn't or wouldn't be done. Did you ever find yourself in a situation where a customer was asking for something that just couldn't be done?
Well, yes, and sometimes you would negotiate that. I think one of the best pilots that I knew while I was over there, a fellow named Ed Reed, really had the right handle on things. He said when a customer asks you to do something, rather than argue about it, take off, fly around the mountain, come back and say that, you know, it's not doable today. The point was, rather than argue on an airstrip, go take a look at what the customer wanted done.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could do it, do it. And if for some reason you couldn't, come back and discuss it with him.
Mm-hmm.
And at least you'd gone out and made the effort to do it.
Mm-hmm. What kind of situations couldn't you do?
Well, I don't think it was a matter of not doing something. I think it was a matter of where a particular individual wanted you to go when you knew that the area was particularly bad.
Mm-hmm.
And see, most of our flying over there, with the exception of special missions, early on in the mid-60 era, was all single pilots. You got single pilot and a crew chief, and you'd fly. You didn't have a co-pilot. It was later on that they had a co-pilot in every aircraft. During that single pilot era, if they were going to run a deep mission into known enemy territory, then you would duel up into what they called a co-captain deal, where two captains would fly in the same aircraft to offer a degree of protection in case you were hit. But by and large, the routine daily work for years was just one pilot and one crew chief assigned per aircraft. And sometimes the customer would ask you to go somewhere where you felt that it might be a little too dangerous for a single pilot operation, and that's where you might want to discuss with the individual that you felt for one reason or another that perhaps you should duel up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was that an easy thing to do in terms of finding
That always involves personalities, and you had some customers who were very, very interested in having a mutual agreement on what's done. Others were a little more dictatorial. Mm-hmm. But pilots are the same way. They're individuals, and mm-hmm. They use their best judgment. And sometimes the two judgments don't jibe exactly. And then usually you have to find an intermediary, one way or the other, to hash it out.
Right.
Well, I don't remember any fistfights or anything
no.
of that nature. No. It was just a difference in perspective, if you will.
But also, but in terms of personnel, you mentioned that one of the possible solutions to, going into a particular area that was hot, find another pilot, go in co-captains.
Yeah.
Was it difficult to find additional personnel to do those types of operations?
Well, it wasn't a matter of finding different personnel. It was a matter of special operations were usually set up in advance, and they put the appropriate number of crew members in each aircraft. In other words, two captains and a crew chief. And rarely were there extemporaneous conditions where you snatched someone else out of an aircraft and brought them to your aircraft or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, for example, the SARs that we talked about, a SAR happens so fast that if you're out there flying alone, you make your best judgment as whether you can get in there and get out, and you'll call other aircraft to come and support you, but you won't necessarily land and put two pilots in a cockpit. You could have two aircraft participating together,
mm-hmm.
Both single-piloted, mm-hmm. but one kind of covering the other as you're trying to extricate the downed pilot.
Okay.
Does this make sense to you? Are you following what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah, in other words, you wouldn't stop to organize a rescue with dual captains and waste that precious 20 minutes I talked about. You just go in there and do your best to get the guy out.
And if you needed additional support, you'd call for other air.
Oh, there was no question. When there's a pilot down, everything stopped. There was all kinds of assets that could be brought to assist you, but the time was the most important thing, and everybody just more or less dropped what they were doing to do the best they could.
Mm-hmm. How many SAR operations or pickups did you conduct?
I'm sorry?
How many pickups did you conduct yourself?
I'd have to go back and look at my logbook, but I think that over the years from my Army time in South Vietnam, my Air America time in Laos, and Air America time back in South Vietnam, it was well over a dozen or more.
Was that
maybe 15 or 16, but sometimes I was just assisting another aircraft doing the pickup. Sometimes I was doing the pickup. Sometimes I was by myself. I never really kept track of it. If I went to my logbook and totaled them up, I'd have some kind of idea, but I've never paid too much attention about it because it was just a routine thing. You, when there was a downed pilot, you did what you had to do to get him out.
Mm-hmm. Was that pretty consistent, do you think? For most Air America pilots?
Oh, I'd say absolutely. I can't imagine any Air America pilot not participating on getting someone out. And in terms of numbers, I would have no idea.
Okay. Well, when you would go on these operations supporting the customers, would you frequently come under fire from the ground?
Oh, you would routinely come under fire, but when we first got over there, most of the fire that you would encounter was small arms and maybe up to including 50 caliber. Toward the end of the war in Laos, which ended in 73, and then later on back over into Vietnam in the 73 to 75 time frame, the armament expanded significantly into heavy anti-aircraft and even missiles.
The
Strela man-packed missile.
Mm-hmm. Did you yourself come under the heavier armed fire?
Yes, but never to where I was struck. You know, you knew you would see tracers going by and so forth, which were obviously not small arms fire, but I was never struck mm-hmm. by anything heavier than small arms.
Mm-hmm. And you were never shot down?
No, I was shot up. I was always able to fly the aircraft where I had to seek maintenance and whatnot, but I was never put in a position in all those years where I had to make a forced landing.
Okay. Could you describe any of the more memorable operations you were involved with?
No, there were so many, and it's over such a long, long time that the only thing in terms of cumulative days and work was the evacuation of Saigon when I was assigned by the chief pilot in Saigon to assist with planning the air evacuation portion of it, and that's a whole chapter in itself.
Mm-hmm. And when you flew for Air America, what was the period, the time frame that you served in Vietnam for Air America?
Well, I went with Air America, as I said before, uh-huh. in the summer of 67 to Udorn,
right.
and stayed there until early 73. When they were closing down the operation up in Udorn, and quite a number of us transferred down to Saigon in the spring of 73, and then stayed, worked out of Saigon until evacuation day, which was the 29th of April of 75.
Yes, sir. But did your mission and operations, did they change when you went from Udorn to Saigon?
To a degree, because the war had really wound down. In 73, all American activity was out of Vietnam, with the exception of the DAO, the Defense Attaché's Office.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, things had gone back to mostly a support role, prisoner exchanges, supporting the International Control Commission, administrative duties on behalf of the Defense Attaché's Office and the South Vietnamese government
mm-hmm.
For those last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So when you were in Saigon, you weren't flying customers around like you were flying them in Laos?
Well, yes, we were, but the customers were still there and the work was still there, but the tempo mm-hmm. of the activity
okay.
Was not as great.
Okay. Were prisoner exchanges frequent?
Well, toward the end of the war, when they had the International Control Commission there, yes, we'd fly into areas and work with that, and then we'd also work with the JCRC, which was the Joint Recovery for looking for the missing Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And we cooperated in that quite a bit, too.
Okay. I haven't heard about that before. Is this something that...
Well, the JCRC was formed, and it's still in existence, as a matter of fact. It's run out of... Hawaii, and they send teams now of actually pathologists over to Vietnam. In fact, I think when Clinton visited there, they had some things when they'd found the remains of an Air Force pilot, as I recall,
yes, sir.
Navy or Air Force pilot. But our working with the JCRC down in Vietnam in the 73-75 time frame was they had computer lists, as I recall, and this is just from deep memory, but approximately 3,500 Americans were unaccounted for
mm-hmm.
at the end of the war. When I say the end of the war, that was the 1973 time frame when the Americans had left Vietnam, and they had groups of people connected with the JCRC that were going out, Air America, we would fly them out, and we would try and discover where that aircraft had gone down or where that incident took place to see if we could find remains.
Mm-hmm.
And we were quite successful with some of them and whittling down this long list
mm-hmm.
of talking to villagers and finding out an aircraft had landed here at a certain time and going out and finding perhaps a wristwatch or an ID card or something that you know, would stand up to the elements.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking at all missing Americans from the start of the engagement over there. So some of the things went back into the early 60s.
Yes, sir. I didn't mean I hadn't heard of the Joint Recovery System. I hadn't heard of Air America's involvement in that.
Well, they had representatives over there, and we
right.
would they would essentially be the customer for that day,
mm-hmm.
And they would say, "I have a reported site at XYZ coordinates. Mm-hmm. Let's go out there and take a look and see what we can find."
Mm-hmm.
And we would take them out, and often one was memorable to me because when the first cab first came to Vietnam back in '65, they came in at Quy Nhon.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out in the 73-74 time frame looking for a fellow, a FAC, in an L-19 who got caught in weather and was trying to land at Quy Nhon and never showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And in a village just south of Quy Nhon on the beach, we were informed that there were some parts down there. And what had occurred, the L-19 had landed on the beach, and someone had shot the pilot, and the village was so concerned that repercussions would be made that they buried the pilot and disassembled the aircraft and buried the aircraft.
Yeah.
But they were able to, when we got up there, they were able to present watch and ID card, as I recall, dog tags.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a resolution of one of the cases.
Okay.
And that was, many years afterwards.
Yes. Were there other similar examples?
Oh yeah, I don't recall any that were precisely resolved, but we would go out and we would ferry the customer to where he would inquire of it, and then we'd look around and fly him around the area to see if we could find any traces of wreckage, things of that nature. But that's pretty dicey business because most of that stuff is just subsumed by jungle over a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Did you yourself speak the language, or?
No, I did not.
You never received language training?
No.
Okay. Do you recall if there were any other similar events in terms of a village or a group of villagers kind of trying to bury the evidence because of fear of reprisal?
Well, I think I would venture to say that was probably a common occurrence,
mm-hmm.
That they would try to cover things up.
Mm-hmm.
But as a matter of nature, but not as a matter of policy so much.
Yes, sir.
And a lot of the cases, these were aircraft just simply flying into mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And in the bad weather that was over there and so forth. In other words, there was no enemy activity involved whatsoever. It was just flying into a mountain, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And then the jungle reclaiming the wreckage.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of flying in the mountains, very difficult part of flying in Laos was especially during weathers, was the karst mountains and cloud cover and all kinds of issues.
Yeah, weather was quite a phenomenon, but it was once you were over there for a full year,
mm-hmm.
every year was repeated. In other words, you had a dry season, and you had a rainy season, you had a smoky season, because of the, especially in Laos, where the Hmongs their agriculture was a slash and burn.
Mm-hmm.
Agriculture to replenish the nitrites into the soil. So great inversions would occur in between the two monsoons that cover that, and let me get this straight in my mind. You had a northeast monsoon,
mm-hmm.
and you had a southwest monsoon, and they change every year. But generally, starting in about the December-January time frame was called the smoky season, when they did their slash and burn,
mm-hmm.
and then the rains would come in the May to June time frame, and then later on in the autumn and the winter, it would be clear and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And that was predictable year after year after year.
Mm-hmm.
That inversion layer comes in and settles in, and it's very smoky, and vision is almost, any lateral vision is almost impossible. You look down through the chin bubble of the helicopter, you see the ground below you, but looking at it at an angle, it just disappears in the smoke.
Wow.
It's like a fog, if you would, or a smog.
Mm-hmm. From what altitude did seeing the ground become a significant problem?
Just about any altitude, as a matter of fact. But by and large, the kind of the rule of thumb, both in Vietnam and in Laos, was that if you could stay out of tracer burnout, and tracer burnout for a small arms is about 700 meters, mm-hmm. and for 50 caliber is about 1,000 meters. So if you could stay 1,500, 2,000 feet above the ground, you were pretty well out of harm's way mm-hmm. in terms of small arms fire. Okay. And so those are the altitudes that we were generally working at. But as the rainy season came in, you'd get a lot lower.
Why lower?
Well, you'd because you'd have cloud formations in there, and it was peculiar up in the mountains that if you got under the bases of the clouds, the visibility was marvelous because the rain washes the air, washes all the smoke away.
Okay.
And we didn't do the fixed wing did instrument flying up there, but the helicopters, by and large, were all VFR operation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess for you, the areas in which you worked and the pilots that you worked with, what was the most common cause of crashes and accidents?
Well, I would say that the weather, mm-hmm. in terms of, if you're excluding enemy action, mm-hmm. I would say that the weather was probably the second, well, not the second major cause, was if you're talking purely accidents, mm-hmm. It would be weather in one combination or another.
Okay.
And then just off the top of my head, I'd say probably overloading of the aircraft would probably be the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And we had such wonderful maintenance. The Air America maintenance was so good that mechanical failure, in other words, failure of the aircraft itself, was very, very rare.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of overloaded, what model Hueys did you guys get?
Well, we started with the D model mm-hmm. Huey. Well, we had Bs and Ds, and they had the L-11 Lycoming engine in them, which was really not conducive to Laotian operations because the altitude and temperatures over there, and later they were converted to the L-13 engine, which had a little more horsepower and gave you a margin of error.
Mm-hmm.
But you can basically, at least for the technology of that time, you can overload any aircraft on any given day.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not careful, and because the density altitudes were so high over there that you could end up with very little power to spare. If you're trying to make approaches into mountainous pads and you judge the winds improperly, you could put yourself in a precarious position.
Mm-hmm. What, and your transporting of the customers, it was those groups were primarily Laotians, correct? And the customer? Or?
Yes, Laotians and customer, and later on there was ties that were a part of it that mm-hmm. were employed to work up in Laos.
These are the Thai mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think, as an American, as a former intelligence officer, what did you think about the conduct of the United States effort in Laos and Vietnam?
Well, it's hard to frame that. There's a I'm trying to think of something in my mind that. Was an adage some time after the war, and it's in reference to Korea, and it said that from the perspective of World War II, Korea, the Korean War, was a failure.
Mm-hmm.
From the perspective of Vietnam, the Korean War was a success.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to sit here. You can read McNamara's Mea Culpa mm-hmm. and the other books written about the war. It's hard from this perspective to look back and assign direct blame. You have to frame it in the politics of the time. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the politics, as I mentioned earlier, involved the concept of containment. That was the national policy.
Mm-hmm.
So in retrospect, it's easy to say now that the whole thing was a tragic mistake, because if we had done nothing, probably at the very worst in North Vietnam, it would have become a Southeast Asian Albania. Mm-hmm. In other words, during the height of the Cold War, Albania was fervently communist, but it was a pimple on our ass mm-hmm. in terms of American national policy. And if Vietnam had gone totally communist in the early 60s or mid-60s, it would probably have had no repercussions in terms of our national stature. Mm-hmm. And I think this is, if you read Colin Powell and you read about the Desert Storm, this was a specific interest, the interest of oil, that caused that. And the liabilities are tremendous if the United States loses access to Middle Eastern oil. Mm-hmm. But as far as losing access to any raw material that Vietnam could have provided, it wasn't a national priority. Most of the reason we got in over there was because of containment. And why we stayed is because we were afraid to get out.
But not so much retrospectively. But do you remember what you thought at the time?
Oh, at the time, we thought what we were doing was right. Most of, in fact, almost all of Air America were ex-military pilots from one branch of the military to the other. And we felt what we were doing was in support of national interests. And we didn't dwell on what the national interests were. We didn't have long discussions about that, but I think we all felt we were doing what was right at the time.
Right. Was there anything about flying for Air America that you liked more about flying compared to flying for the Army, flying for the military?
Air America, when judged against my military experience, Air America was probably the most professional organization that I ever experienced. The integrity of the individuals, the supervisory management, particularly at the bases where we worked. I'm not talking about upper management because I had no contact with that, but the immediate management, people like Wayne Knight, Clarence Abbey, Marius Burke, all of these people made the job a true pleasure. And let me put it this way. If Air America was still in existence and I was still flying, that's where I'd want to be. It was a magnificent experience. The people I worked with were absolutely grand. The maintenance was just phenomenal. You probably heard that the Army ended up bringing the aircraft to us to maintain in Udorn because they'd give their aircraft away to the maintenance and not see it for 2 or 3 weeks, while we would generally turn around routine maintenance overnight for them. They'd bring it in the afternoon. The people would work on it all night. We'd test fly it for them in the morning and send them on their way.
Wow.
So it was truly a phenomenal operation in that regard and highly professional. And I can't think of anyone that I came in contact with Air America in those years that I would really dislike.
Mm-hmm. But, now, I'm not trying to get you to say anything negative or bad, but compared to the Army, were these problems when you were flying in the Army?
No. The Army, the Army by its very nature is transient. And people are always coming and going and touring out and so forth. And you don't have the consistency that you had with Air America. People came over there and stayed for long periods. In the Army, the tour in Vietnam was 1 year.
Right.
You were in constant transition.
Yep.
And people were being moved in and out of command billets to punch their cards and so forth, which is a typical Army thing. And this is negative. It's just simply the fact of life. But in Air America, you had people that came and were with Air America for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And when you have that kind of consistency and continuity in the effort, it's got to be better, just by the nature of the thing.
Do you think that that's an important lesson we might be able to take away from the overall experience?
Well, I don't know how applicable it is. If there's a need for another operation like Air America, it will find its continuity on its own.
Mm-hmm.
To turn to the armed forces and say, you're going to go to war, bud, and you're going to stay there until it ends.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was World War II,
mm-hmm.
you know, the old duration plus six.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't encountered anything like that since World War II. I would go back to that, and that's where they failed in Vietnam. I think they should have signed a point system
mm-hmm.
where if you were in a active infantry unit, you might get 3 points a day.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were in Saigon, as a clerk in Saigon, you might get a quarter of a point a day. And then when you'd acquired so many points, you were rotated.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than rotating everybody on a year's basis, you're just continuously relearning
right. The
war. But that's policies far above me.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But the things that you emphasized as the strengths and the reasons why you liked being a part of Air America, the professionalism, the commitment, the consistency, the knowledge that was acquired over so many years that made Air America such a great, not just a great place to work, but a very effective organization at their job. If Air America is effective as a result of those types of characteristics and the fact that these people are there for the long duration, I was just wondering if you thought that might be an applicable military lesson that might be derived.
Well, it might be an applicable lesson, but how do you enforce it? I mean,
mm-hmm.
do you take... we had enough problem mm-hmm. in Vietnam. And this has nothing to do with Clinton, and it has nothing to do with Dick Armey, and
mm-hmm.
it has nothing to do with the rest of the crowd. But if you could afford, or your parents could afford to keep you in college, you were basically permanently deferred from Vietnam. And so people who didn't want to go for one reason or another didn't
mm-hmm.
particularly have to.
Right.
So are you going to take people who either... don't have the capability to stay perpetually in college
mm-hmm.
and say, okay, you're going to stay perpetually in the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a good thing either. I'm sorry they did away with the draft, but they had to at the time because it was politically unsustainable
mm-hmm.
with the reaction that Nixon was getting from what was going on back in the States.
Mm-hmm.
But do you take a particular group of people and tell them that you're going to go to a battlefield and serve there in perpetuity?
Mm-hmm.
That's not practical at all.
Mm-hmm. Unless it's an all-volunteer force. Unless it's an all-volunteer
force. Oh, no. Even with there'll be a rebellion. You can't take a segment of the all-volunteer army and stake them out somewhere and say, don't come back unless it's on your shield.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a rotation policy in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so with the volunteer army, because when I first entered the army in the 50s, the comment was, if we wanted you to have a wife, we would have issued you one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at $79 a month, you couldn't afford one. So privates and corporals and junior sergeants were living in the barracks. They weren't married.
Right.
But now you have privates who are married.
Mm-hmm.
And can you imagine taking a group of people and staking them out in Kosovo and saying, well, you're here until it's over?
Mm-hmm.
The hue and cry will be horrendous. Wives will be going to the senators, and the senators and congressmen will be attacking the president, whoever they are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about finished now with the time I can commit today.
Let me go ahead and end this officially for the day.
Okay.
This will end the first interview with Mr. Nicky Filippi. Thank you, sir. This is Steve Maxter continuing the interview with Mr. Nicky Filippi. It is the 2nd of February, 2001, at approximately 3:15. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Filippi is in Seattle, Washington. All right, sir, why don't you discuss the role of opium as you understood it in Laos and I guess in terms of Air America and other stuff?
Well, to the extent that when we initially got over there, it was well known because we were flying in the opium fields in northern Laos that opium was basically a cash crop for the Hmong or Mayo that we were supporting. It had been
grown in Laos for many, many years in the highlands of Laos, which was conducive to growing of the opium poppies. There was some speculation during the war that Air America was involved in drug trafficking, and that was amplified by the movie Air America that was produced in the early 90s. But to the best of my knowledge, in the 8 years that I was with Air America, I never knew of anybody involved in either gun running or dealing in opium or any of its derivatives, heroin, opium, or any of the derivatives for profit.
Now, one of the questions that we had discussed previously in terms of the possible uses of opium in Laos, you said you didn't have any specific or personal knowledge that it was actually used as payment to soldiers, but you mentioned that it was used for barter.
Well, no, traditionally, opium had been used for barter, and it had been used medicinally by the Highland Laos and Highland Vietnamese in its base form of opium. But the major preponderance of opium in Southeast Asia is purchased at that time. The French and Corsican connections purchased the opium, and then it was refined into heroin for markets around the world. But so there was a definite profit in heroin, but that's further down the course from the actual growing of opium and collecting opium. So the profits are all made at the opposite end of the line, and the price that the Laos were selling opium for was minuscule compared to its basic profitability when it's refined into heroin.
Okay. Now, last time, in our last interview, we spoke a lot about the search and rescue operations that were part of the Air America mission. But as you pointed out, this is a very small portion. And I thought maybe it would be important for you to talk about that.
Well, we discussed the fact that SAR was the SAR missions are not pre-planned.
Right.
They occur spontaneously when a aircraft goes down, whether it's an Air America aircraft or Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine aircraft. The people that were participating in the war in Southeast Asia, it's extemporaneous in its reaction to an immediate crisis, and then when that crisis is resolved, in other words, the downed pilots are rescued, then everything is back to normal again. And it was just you think of it as a collateral duty of Air America, but the primary duty of Air America in Laos and in Vietnam were supporting the U.S. government with flight operations for whatever they wanted done, and in Laos, of course, it was in support of the Laotian military effort against the Pathet Lao and the North Vietnamese.
Now, you mentioned that you went back and looked at your logbook, and could you discuss that a little bit in terms of looking at how many hours?
Well, no, I just reviewed my logbook and reviewed the fact that periodically there would be SAR missions that would take place, and I received letters from people who I picked up and so forth, and it was always a gratifying experience, but as I say, once again, these were few and far between when you consider the fact that I spent an entire 10 years in Southeast Asia in aviation in one form or another. My first SAR actually was while I was still in the Army over in Vietnam, and a couple of Air Force people had been shot down, and we extracted them in short order and got them back to their base and then went about our business. So the transition from doing it while I was in the Army to doing it while I was with Air America was just a straight pass through. When a pilot goes down, you do your best to get him out.
And when that happened, when you were in the Army, what I guess reports or whatever did you file concerning that particular SAR operation?
I didn't file any report at all. I went in and we were close. We heard the Mayday and checked my map and saw I was very close and knew the area and knew it was contested, and came up and told the Air Force overhead SAR control that I was available in the area, and they said that there were resources that were being rounded up at that time to come out there, and I said that we were only minutes away, and we felt we could safely get in and get the two pilots out, which we did, and proceeded north from the crash site to a base. This all took place in the Mekong Delta, to a site called Bantui, and just dropped, it was an Air Force base, dropped in there, and dropped the pilots off to Air Force folk, and refueled, and went about our business. And didn't write up, well, I ended up eventually recognizing my gunner and flight mechanic for what they had performed that day in aiding and getting these fellows on the aircraft, and they received awards for it, but as far as I was concerned, it was just a part of a day's work.
Okay. So really not very much difference from the time you were in the Army to the time
No, not at all, not at all.
Now, the other missions that, and the other, I guess, emergency types of scenarios that you would find yourself in when you flew for Air America in Laos, are there any particular events that stand out, in particular like a medevacs or hot extractions, hot exfiltration?
Oh, there were quite a variety of those over the years. Where, as I mentioned before, we would double up and fly what they called co-captain at the time, two captains in one aircraft, to go rather deeply into contested or enemy-held territory and either deliver troops on the ground or extract them, but no single incident stands out. I would say that the most hectic and the most memorable portion were the last 2 or 3 weeks down in Saigon as we prepared for what eventually became the evacuation of Vietnam. That, of course, was a planned event in terms of preparing for that, but all of the well, we had done some preceding evacuation down the Vietnamese coast as the North Vietnamese more or less rolled up the country, so it wasn't a surprise when we had to evacuate Saigon. But those approximately 2 months before the evacuation of Saigon, we were all kept pretty busy.
Now, I do want to talk about your work in preparing and evacuating Saigon, but your mention of that not being a surprise prompts another question. Did you all hear about, or what did you hear about the Tet Offensive of 68?
Well, the Tet Offensive took place in 68, and the people to talk to about the impact of the Tet Offensive are the folks that were in Air America that were assigned to the Vietnam office at that time. As I say, my tenure in Laos ran from 67 to 73, so I was in Laos during the Tet Offensive.
Right.
And we were very well aware that it was going on, but it had minimal, if any, impact on us where we were, as opposed to the pilots who were involved in Vietnam.
Well, I'm just curious if it had, what you all thought about that offensive in light of the effects that it eventually had back in the United States, of course, were rather profound politically. And I was just curious if in Laos you had heard about that, or what you heard. You know, what
well,
did you know
I received, as I mentioned in our last interview, wherever I go in the world, I always subscribe to the three major news weeklies. And between the newspapers and the major news weeklies, I was well aware, maybe a week or two behind, but I was well aware of everything that was going on in the rest of the world. And, of course, at the time, it took a while to regain the ground lost in the Tet Offensive, but within very short order, it was policed up, and from a standpoint of a military activity, it was an overall loss to the North Vietnamese, as far as if you view it as a political activity, and then more historically from further on into 69, 70, 71, 72, it had a horrendous impact, as you just mentioned, to the people back in the United States from the White House on down. Everybody had been more or less surprised by the strength of the activity displayed by the North Vietnamese during the Tet Offensive. And it's basically to blame for the fact that President Johnson refused to run again for the presidency. It brought his presidency to an end. And but those impacts took place after Tet itself. It was just another call it an uprising, but of a higher level by North Vietnamese that set it off. But tactically, it was a battlefield loss, but mm-hmm. politically, it was a battlefield gain of some import.
Right. Now, what did you all know, or what did you think about Johnson's decision not to run for election?
Oh, I didn't really pay any attention to it. I follow the U.S. news, but it didn't really have an impact as such.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, were these topics of conversation amongst the pilots, Air America pilots? You know, did you talk about these types of events? And
not that I recall. There were no deep political or philosophical discussions that I remember. Mm-hmm. By and large, when you're overseas, you're away from your community. So local political activities such as senators and house members from your various districts, or for example, last night I sat down and my wife and I filled out absentee ballots for a school bond issue here in Seattle. That type of thing we would never have been doing over in Laos. So we were divorced from local political activity, and at the most we would have thought about national political activity, but really didn't concern ourselves to any great extent as to what was going on at that level. At least I didn't. Although I had an interest in it, mm-hmm. I had no deep conversations about it.
Okay. And what did you guys do for rest and relaxation?
Many of the folks, my family, as I said, I was married and ended up with a daughter, but I had my family located in Bangkok, so I would go down and visit them mm-hmm. monthly when I'd get time off. Most of the time I was batching it up in Udorn, and when I wasn't working up country, so I didn't have a family with me, but many of the folks had their families right up in Udorn, and it was just general family life. A lot of the social activities took place around the club set up at Udorn, where they had an Air America club with a swimming pool and restaurants and bars. And then we were located on an Air Force base, so they had the Air Force facilities there also, and restaurants downtown. And it was just a normal home life when you were back in Udorn. When you were living up country, we had hostels where we slept and ate. And it was not dissimilar to a military barrack style life while you were up country. But by and large, the quality of life was very good and very enjoyable, either whether you were up country or whether you were back at your home base.
Now, regarding other types of missions or flights that you would engage in, did you ever support U.S. Army 6th Special Forces Group or Project 404 that you know of?
I'm trying to remember, and I don't think I had any missions involving American troops. Most of all the missions I was involved in involved Asian troops of one stripe or another.
Mm-hmm. Were there South Vietnamese soldiers active in Laos that you were aware of?
Not that I recall. The only we supported Laotians and we supported the Thais.
Yes.
They were euphemistically called the Thai mercenaries, but the Thai soldiers that were aiding the Laotians, we supported both of those nationalities. I don't recall supporting any South Vietnamese in Laos. Of course, we supported South Vietnamese in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the interaction like between Laotian and Thai forces in the field? Do you know?
Well, I never saw any difficulties at all. We were either working with one or the other. I don't remember working with mixed groups.
Okay.
But we worked with one or the other, and everything was quite satisfactory.
Okay. And let's see. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about with regard to your time in Laos?
No, it was, as I say, it was a very interesting 6 years, and I would probably just say the same things that your other participants are saying, that there were a lot of moments of excitement, a lot of moments of routine work. As I mentioned to you before, flying was hazardous there under the best of circumstances when the altitude or weather were against you, but by and large, as you learned your way around the country, you knew the places to avoid because, as we said in our first interview, our intelligence was such that, by and large, you could fly around areas that were known to be enemy. Sometimes you'd stumble into a place that hadn't been identified, and that could be a little trying, but just being there and the continuity of being there kept us quite safe.
Actually, I do have one last question about Laos. Mm-hmm. Was there anything, is there anything that comes to mind that you recall as being a particularly brave or a particularly brave act?
Fellows that were over there, in fact, quite a few of the fellows did things that, if they had been in the military, mm-hmm. Would have been recognized with high honors over the years. But as far as I was concerned, there was nothing I did that was heroic, although other people had gone on some deep missions or some particularly harrowing SARS and medevacs would have been awarded high awards if they'd been in the military at the time.
Mm-hmm. But is there any particular act that's, of someone else?
I'd have to go back and really do some thinking and looking about, but names like Scratch Kanak, Ed Reed, Dick Casterlin, all jump out as being participants in things. Al Cates. It's been so many years, and it's been so many years since I've seen these people that some of the names don't come back to mind immediately, but there are many people over there that did some absolutely wonderful things.
Yeah. Okay. Well, would you go ahead and describe the activities you engaged in preparation for the evacuation of Saigon? What kind of planning did you have to assume?
Well, initially, Saigon started to fall apart starting out in the January time frame of 1975 and proceeding up to the culmination with the evacuation of Saigon on 29 April. Sometime about the May time frame, we started losing the upcountry sites like Da Nang and Nha Trang, and we would evacuate people out of those various sites coming southward down the Vietnam coast. And then approximately, 6 weeks, let me check something here. I think it was about 6 weeks before the evacuation of Saigon, they assembled a group of us to support the ambassador's plans, and they called it the Special Planning Group from the Defense Attaché's office, and it was in operation mostly between 7 April and 29 April. And the planning committee was looking at the possibility of having to evacuate Saigon, and they took three approaches to it. They took a orderly movement going, in other words, with plenty of warning, people would just evacuate safely by ground, ship, and air. And then if things got worse, the ground effort might be impeded, and we might have to do rooftop evacuations to get the people either to boats in the South China Sea or back out to the airport. And we looked at these eventualities, and we earmarked a number of places in downtown Saigon to build heliports where we could collect people if it degenerated to that type of a thing. And I was attached by the chief pilot in Saigon to work with DAO. And I proceeded to look at, survey about 30-plus buildings in downtown Saigon to determine the suitability for landing sites. And out of those 37, I think we chose approximately a dozen rooftops. And with the aid of people from the Pacific architecture and engineers and local indigenous folks, we went out and surveyed and cleared those rooftops of all obstructions so day or night operations, flight operations could be performed, and designed a pattern for a H, as in letter H, that the helicopter could land to night or day. Mm-hmm. And as things turned out, on the 29th of April, things degenerated over the 28th, 29th very rapidly, and we had to resort to having air operations extract people off those rooftops. And we'd been coordinating with the Marines in that previous month or so, and we'd made the decision that the Marines would handle evacuation from Tonsonaut Air Base and from the U.S. Embassy, and Air America would handle evacuation from these downtown sites, bringing the people out to the airport for the Marines to transport out to the fleet. And that kind of fell apart, too, because the everything was so pandemonious the last day that Air America aircraft were actually going out to the South China Sea and dropping people and then coming back into town and picking up more and taking them back. But it all culminated in that one hectic 48-hour period prior to 30 April of 1975. And I think we were successful in evacuating a number of thousands of people out to the ships mm-hmm. before the whole thing folded up.
Now, did you guys refuel out at the ship? Or
I'm sorry?
Did you refuel out at the ships? Where did you get your...
Well, I stayed on the ground all day coordinating air operations, and then the aforementioned Ed Reed and myself had a helicopter that we had placed near us in what had been Westmoreland's headquarters. That's where we were running the operations out of. And we kept it there on the ground all day and worked the ground air operations out of that headquarters. And then in the evening, it was the 29th of April around 6 o'clock, we departed Saigon and flew out to the Hancock, and that was the end of it. But Air America aircraft worked all day long, mm-hmm. Picking up people from the sites that I'd established and getting them out to the airport while we, Ed and I, were involved with command and control mm-hmm. at the airport itself.
Were you picking up particular people or the people at random?
Well, actually, they were picking up people who had been told to proceed to that particular rooftop. In other words, the various customers that we supported told their people that they're in the event of aerial evacuation, they were to proceed to these various rooftops in town. And that's, of course, one of them is the site of the famous picture that came out of the Southeast Asian War, an Air America helicopter off the rooftop, one of the rooftops that I had prepared in Saigon, and taking people off the top of the elevator shaft.
That was the Pullman? What was the...
Yeah, I forget right now. Yeah. I think you've got it right. Pittman Building.
Pittman Building, that's right.
And it was one of the agency's buildings, and we'd gone up there and surveyed it and had huge ladders. I designed some ladders that were made by Pacific Architects and Engineer, and there are two ladders, one from the rooftop to a smaller structure, and then from that smaller structure up to the top of the elevator shaft. Mm-hmm. And the famous picture is one of our Hueys, poised up there picking up people.
Wow. Now, when you were picking the sites, I assume you had to take certain structural aspects of the buildings into context.
Yeah, precisely. We had to go up there and survey the roof and try and determine if it would hold the weight of the helicopter, mm-hmm. and then look around the roof and clear all obstructions that might interfere with the rotor blades or the tail rotor of the helicopter, and doing that in both directions. And aligning the H so if at night a person had to come in there, as long as he landed with his skids on the H, mm-hmm. We had guaranteed him a 360-degree clearance. Mm-hmm. We used acetylene torches, which were very quiet, of course, and were able to cut down such things as flagpoles or any kind of lines that were up there, telephone lines, things of that nature, to ensure that we would normally reroute electrical lines, but we would cut down lines that would present an obstruction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And to your knowledge, on those sites that Air America was evacuating from, did they have the same problem of large numbers of Vietnamese trying to clamber aboard?
As far as I know, yes. All the places that did have, they had, it was quite a panic situation, and they all had difficulties. But since I was on the ground at Tonsonut for that day, that's second and third hand information. It's better to talk to the pilots that were participating that day.
Yes, sir. Now, and when you took off with the person who you were working with there, did you bring any back? Did you grab any back?
No, we had military personnel from the defense attaché's office on a full helicopter full as we proceeded out to the Hancock that night. The people that were working there on the ground trying to regulate the flow of refugees.
Did you hear of any incidents at the embassy that day? Any particular incidents besides the evacuation, of course?
I'm sorry, say again?
Do you remember if you heard of any particular incidents that occurred at the embassy that day that they were evacuating?
Oh, no. The person, read Decent Interval by Snap. Are you familiar with that book?
Yes, sir.
Okay, read Decent Interval because... I was doing things out at Tonsonut that Snep was involved with and at the embassy. Mm-hmm. I can speak for a lot of the stuff that went on at Tonsonut and nothing about the embassy. Yeah. And Snep can speak for things at the embassy, but little or nothing that went on about on that day at Tonsonut.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is I've talked to a Marine who was there that last day, and he tells a very harrowing tale of having to actually shoot into a group of Vietnamese.
No, I know nothing about that.
I didn't know if you'd heard of that.
And we didn't have to do that at Tonsonut. In fact, we had people in very good order. We'd lined them up inside this building that used to be called Pentagon East, Westmoreland's command post there, and we had them in the halls, and we had them lined up, and everything was quite well organized out where we were. The day was pandemonious because there were enemy shells. They'd started firing the night before, and they were landing around the area, but none landed in amongst us, and I think that was with intent because the North Vietnamese were very good gunners, and they could have really shut us down. And I've never thought, and history shows that it was not their intent to kill a bunch of Americans that day. They simply wanted us to leave, and so I think they had very firm marching orders. To minimize casualties on the part of America because they would eventually want to seek rapprochement with us. And there were very few casualties. Two Marines were killed the night before. I talked to them as I drove out to bring some pilots in, and a round landed in their foxhole, as it were, rocket round, and killed them. But it wasn't intentional because it was just beyond the Air America ramp, and they'd been trying to shell the ramps. But this thing was just, the rockets are not that accurate, so this thing was just a fluke.
Now, what was the military presence at Tonsonut that last day? How many soldiers and Marines were there?
Well, I have no count on that. Now, the Marines, of course, were out on out in the fleet. And they were, our original planning had them set to arrive about 7 or 8 in the morning, but they didn't get into, as I recall, till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon because there were refueling problems and things like that on board the carriers. But we had the U.S. Marine presence there, and then all the rest of the people, of course, were evacuees of any stripe. They were wearing, most of them wearing civilian clothes. And then the staff from the defense attaché's office, who was assisting all of this.
Well, what did you think about the Paris Peace Accords of 73?
I don't think we had any immediate thought about it. I came down from Laos to Vietnam, and in retrospect, if you read Snep's book, it appears like there was an intentional interval, a decent interval placed in there before we could wash our hands of it. But on the day-to-day basis, we were still working. The military, by and large, had left Vietnam in 73, with the exception of the defense attaché's office. There was still plenty of work for us to do, and I don't recall people sitting around reflecting on high-level politics.
Well, I guess, especially in the context of the interval between the Paris peace talks and the fall of Saigon in April of 1975, the transition from providing support for the South Vietnamese to no support.
Well, I think a lot of us thought that we would still be there, that things would calm down. We never expected it to go. I don't think the North Vietnamese expected it to go down the tube as quickly as it did. I think they were positioning for ground and so forth because, of course, a lot of them were left in South Vietnam at the end of the war, and I think they were positioning themselves for property up in the highlands of South Vietnam and the border with North Vietnam. But I don't think in their wildest imagination they think that South Vietnam fell as quickly as it did. And most of us were thinking that just like after CNC and Civil Air Transport and the predecessors of Air America left China in 49 and went out to Taiwan, they continued to operate for years. And we felt that we would probably, a lot of us felt we would probably be there for quite a few years, that the military, U.S. military, would not come back into Vietnam under any circumstances, and we'd be there for years and years and years supporting the South Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm. So the withdrawal of American support was...
I'm sorry?
The withdrawal of American support was kind of a surprise then. That is...
No. There had been a trend through the Nixon years to what I call Vietnamization from
right.
our first
right.
conversation. So
right.
there was no question that the Americans were pulling out. That was not the question at
no,
all.
No, but in terms of the support that we continue to provide them even after the Paris peace talks.
Oh.
And then all of a sudden, Congress's decision, bang, we're not going to give them any more weapons, any more financial support, any more material support.
Yeah, that... I wouldn't say that was a big surprise. It was a feeling it was generally headed that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we reinforced our feelings that working sub rosa, we would probably be there for some while
mm-hmm.
in support of that because with the deniability, the agency could continue to support
mm-hmm.
Activities and we would be there in support of the agency. So I don't know that... A lot of us thought it was going to end up that abruptly,
mm-hmm.
or end that abruptly.
Right. What did you do after you left Vietnam?
Well, I went back. We ended up in Manila,
mm-hmm.
and Ed Reed asked me to stay on, make sure that all of our pilots were accounted for, and we did that. We made sure everybody was accounted for, and then we repaired to Hong Kong, and the company gave us 2 weeks before they disbanded us. They gave us 2 weeks in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Sheridan, and I had my wife come up and stay with me. And then we proceeded back to Bangkok. And from Bangkok, we visited Iran, where a lot of people
mm-hmm.
had gone to the Bell operation in Iran that was going on simultaneously. And we visited there to some old friends and then came back. And I think we ended up staying... 2 or 3 months and then going back to the States.
Mm-hmm. And
getting back to the States in the summer of 75.
Right. And you mentioned you had account for the pilots and while you were in the Philippines. Were there any significant losses that last day?
No, Air America didn't lose a soul.
Wow.
No. We accounted for all of our, in fact, I accounted for all of our people
mm-hmm.
While we were out on the vessels. We puddled around the South China Sea for 4 or 5 days. And I was able to, using communications, check with other vessels and so forth. And the CEO for Air America was on our vessel, and I was able to report that we had accounted for all of our people. They didn't want to release any information until we'd accounted because it would be embarrassing to say everything was okay and then end up with someone being reported missing or dead.
Right.
So they were adamant about doing it, and the Navy was very good in allowing us to use their communication facility to talk to other vessels and make sure that all our crews were accounted for.
Mm-hmm. Now, something I forgot to ask you. When you transitioned from Laos to Vietnam, did you get shot at as frequently? Or did you get shot at all while you were flying missions over Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. In fact, we lost one bird. I want to say the pilots were Clark and Osterman. They were lost to a Strela missile up by Khe Sanh. And there were still incidents of being shot at, but the weather, with the exception of the highlands and mountains in Vietnam, the weather and the sea level type of flying is much more comfortable, much safer. And I remember getting shot at, but it wasn't as bad as it was up in Laos.
Okay. When you came back to the United States, what kind of welcome did you receive? What was it like coming back?
Well, there was no problem. We'd been coming back periodically on leave, and most of my friends knew I was over there for a protracted period, and the things that you read about the soldiers being spit on and everything else, we never encountered that because we were civilians, and we came back piecemeal. We didn't come back in a mob. I shouldn't use that term, but we didn't come back in a group. Mm-hmm. We came back individually. And so there was, by that time, the decent interval had taken place and people had forgotten about the war.
Mm-hmm.
It was an everyday exercise.
Yes, sir. Now, you said you would come back periodically. When you came back, did you formulate any opinions of the anti-war movement and stuff like that before the end of the war?
No, I was just aware that it was going on, and America, if you explored historically, has always had an anti-war movement. Even the Second World War had the American firsters until Pearl Harbor, which kind of solidified the nation against Japan and Germany. But the Civil War, all of our wars, have had a contingent of people who opposed them. And I never really got involved in it.
Well, I didn't know.
I thought it was, I involved in thinking about it because it's their right to do that.
Yes, sir.
And there was no, there's no animosity on my part toward anyone who felt that they didn't have to go.
Yes, sir. Okay. Now, and then you came back to the United States and you stayed? You didn't go back to Asia after that?
No, I worked contracts in the United States 75 through 79, and then 79 I went to Iran and flew for Bell in Iran in 77. From 75 to 77 I flew contracts. And in 77 I went to Iran and worked there as an instructor pilot until that operation folded up with the evacuation of the Bell helicopter contingent out of that occurred in February of 79 after Khomeini had returned to Iran. And from there we came back to Seattle and I found recall papers for the military. They'd run short of instructor pilots and I was recalled along with a number of other Air America pilots in that 80s time frame. So I finished up my military career between 80 and 90 and retired from the military in 90.
Wow. Now, you were in, where were you in Iran?
Isfahan.
Okay.
And there were a whole gathering of ex-Air America pilots as part of the Bell operation.
Mm-hmm. And you participated in evacuating?
Well, I was involved in the evacuation, but I didn't have the same responsibilities in Iran that I had in Saigon.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
In other words, I was a part
right.
of the evacuees
mm-hmm.
in Iran, whereas I was a planner of the evacuation in Saigon.
Right. Now, the when things started to happen in Iran, what was that like? What was
it degraded very rapidly over a short period of time. It degraded, and the Shah abdicated and left, mm-hmm. and Khomeini came in, and it was obvious at that time that they were under a revolution, and Bell tried to hang on to the last minute, and it was obvious that we'd all have to leave, and we left.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was anybody hurt?
I think a few people were roughed up a little bit, but I'm trying to remember. I don't recall anybody being killed or badly injured.
There was quite a bit of mob violence, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was a lot of mob violence, but it's like any other thing. If you stay out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
If you stay in your home and be sensible, you'll be pretty safe.
Okay. What were the important experiences, lessons that you took away from your experiences in Southeast Asia?
Well,
I think I mentioned this in the first interview, but if an angel was to touch my shoulder and ask me to pick a 10-year period in my life that I enjoyed the most, I'd have to say it was that decade between 65 and 75. Mm-hmm. I got a wife out of it. I had a daughter out of it. I had wonderful companions, wonderful work, exciting times, stimulating times, enjoyable work environment overall. Just everything seemed to click. And I've had a really wonderful life. I have no complaints to speak of at all, but if I was to highlight one decade, that would be it.
I was just going to say, was there a particular lesson that you came away with?
Not really. I didn't go over to learn any particular lesson. I went over to work, and I worked as best I could on both contracts, both the Bell and the Air America contract. I worked up to my last day and left with a very clean taste in my mouth for both the corporation, both corporations, both Bell and Air America. I have no complaint with either one. I never felt I was mistreated. I never felt that I received anything less than I was promised. If that's a lesson to be learned, that would probably be it, that if you have, if you're working for a good corporation, you perform for them and they take care of you.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about America's involvement in Southeast Asia now?
Well, I mentioned this also in the first interview. In retrospect, if we'd have done nothing, it would have probably ended up like a Southeast Asian Albania with the same impact that Albania had in Europe during the communist years on the United States, which is an expression that Scratch Kenak used to use, was minus 0 point shit, and that's exactly the effect that it would have on us. Look what happens, or what has actually happened since the end of the war. It's been a communist nation, while all of the communist nations, by and large, with the exception of China, have the governments have changed. They have not progressed as they wish to progress, but they haven't had any effect on United States national interests. Are you following what I'm saying here? In other words, the existing reunited Vietnam, as it is right now, albeit it's a communist nation, mm-hmm. has had little, if any, impact on our national interests.
Yes, sir.
But the domino theory was prevalent at the time, and they were afraid that if Vietnam fell, then Thailand would fall, and da-da-da-da-da, and it didn't happen. Vietnam did fall. Mm-hmm. Laos, Cambodia fell, but Thailand didn't fall. And Indonesia didn't fall, Malaysia didn't fall. So, Myanmar is in a world of its own, but basically, we lost and nothing changed.
Well, what do you think about deployments of American forces today? That some people have made comments they seem to resemble at times America's involvement in Vietnam, Kosovo, or
well, being a professional military man, as well as my years with Air America, I didn't review the political implications of sending me to Vietnam when I was sent there in 65 mm-hmm. in the military. And whether it's war or a peacekeeping operation, I would much rather favor peacekeeping operations to prevent war mm-hmm. than sitting back and not supporting peacekeeping operations and have them turning into war that you have to fight anyway. Mm-hmm. So as far as where a soldier goes and what he's doing it at the behest of his government. Hopefully his government is making the right choices, but it shouldn't be his or her decision to say, well, I'll only fight wars as a soldier, I won't do peacekeeping missions. That's lunacy.
Of course.
And if we could prevent things with peacekeeping missions, I feel that's the way to go.
Do you think that those policies have been effective?
Well, so far we haven't been in another big shooting war. So to that point, it's been effective.
I think that we have to relook our military structure. We have to measure the threats and whether we can justify keeping a military that was designed for the Cold War in the current circumstances is a question for high-level policymakers. But to justify $400 billion a year, which is where some people would like to go with military expenditures, might be a very difficult thing. The military has been reduced in size. We have to look at each individual commitment and try and get other nations to share with us in sharing those commitments.
Are there any lessons you think we as a nation should have taken away from our experience in Southeast Asia?
Well, I think so. I think we have to look at each thing individually, each instance individually. We have to see how it affects our national interests, how not doing something could eventually affect our national interests. In other words, if we were just to back out and not do anything, and look down the road, but to be proactive, not to pull back into a Fortress America and think that the world can go around about its business and not affect us, especially in the last two administrations, the one that just passed and our current administration, are both forward-looking in terms of global trade. And you can't sit in an island nation, no matter how big the island is, and claim to be a global trader and not be concerned about other things that go on in the world, especially if your economy is based on that global trade.
What do you think about the normalizing of relations with Vietnam?
About what?
About our normalizing of relations.
Oh, Christ, it should have been done years ago. It's amazing how benevolent we are in victory and how short-sighted we are in defeat. When you look at the Marshall Plan and the rebuilding of Japan at the end of World War II, and we seem to be in a fit of pique about Vietnam because we lost over there, I say that within 5 years after the end of the Vietnam War, we should have been back with full normal relationship. Maybe even less, but certainly not more.
Okay. So you completely support what Clinton has done in particular and what we've accomplished so far and what we're trying to accomplish?
Oh, absolutely, but this has nothing to do with Clinton. I'm talking about the whole thing.
Right.
That I think we should have normalized it a long time ago. It doesn't benefit us to still be at odds simply because we got beat.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. I was wondering if you think we should apply the same attitude towards other countries like Cuba.
Oh, that goes without saying. That's nonsensical to have a nation. This goes back to the fear of this fear of communism that drove so many of these issues like Vietnam. And we're sitting here with a nation that's 90 miles away, and relationships should have been restored with Cuba years and years and years ago.
Have you been back to Vietnam? Or would you like to go back?
No, I'd love to go back. No, I have not been back. I would love to go back. It's an absolutely beautiful country with wonderful people and vast potential. And I think I mentioned when we were doing the prisoner exchanges with the ICCS, we would fly into North Vietnamese territory, and they would host us and have a lunch for us, steak and salads and whatnot. And I found the North Vietnamese most engaging, very, very charming. I have no animosity whatsoever towards Vietnamese, either north or south, and I would love to see the country reach its full potential, which I think is enormous.
Yes, sir. You didn't really mention that much about that aspect of the prisoner exchanges. I didn't realize you...
It's just that in Vietnam, in that period from 73 to 75, we were in the process of exchanging prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And we were flying in two different uniforms. We had our Air America livery on our Air America birds, and we had ICCS livery on the ICCS birds for the International Control Commission, and we wore different insignia on our uniforms, but we were the same guys doing the same job.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often we'd fly into Well, in fact, when Osterman and Clark were shot down, they were on an ICCS mission, as I recall, and they got off course, and they were shot down up by Quezon.
Okay.
But that was basically a screw-up more than anything else, because there was a North Vietnamese on board the aircraft. So it wasn't with malice. It was just something happened that wasn't supposed to happen that caused that incident that day. But by and large, we were treated very nicely, as we would accompany the Poles and the it was the Poles and the Iranians and Hungarians and Indonesians. The Canadians were there for a while, but they pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
And we would fly back into these camps and sit there and wait for them to conduct their business. But as I said, we were talking to North Vietnamese political officers.
Mm-hmm.
While we were sitting there on the ground, and there was never any animosity as far as I could see one way or the other.
Wow. Now, when you talked to the North Vietnamese, did you have interpreters?
That's why I say these were either intelligence or political officers, because they all spoke English.
Okay. Yeah.
I was protected from that. My father was too young for the First World War and too old for the Second. So I was protected from any of the animosities evolved out of the Second World War in terms of animosity toward Germans or Japanese. And I formed my own opinions of the Asians while I was over there. And as I say, I married one.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no animosity at all towards the North Vietnamese, even though we lost a number of people over the years. They were doing their job, and I was doing mine.
That's right. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
Not at the moment, but I'm always available to chat up anything specific if you come up with specific questions. And then I'll plan to see you down in Las Vegas. But in the meantime, feel free to call me if you have anything of particular nature that you want amplified.
I sure will. Let me go ahead and end this officially real quick. Right? This will end the interview with Mr. Mickey Phillippe.